There is another relationship that we might consider, and that is our attitude in a general way to the world around us. As we've just observed, this society under God, and not by our invention, has tremendous natural advantages in an uncertain world. We don't have to take the kind of responsibility that other societies must. Now, we are too often, I think, prone to brag of these natural advantages as though they were virtues, when in reality they are gifts which have come to us, which are inherent in our situation. So let us no longer talk of our virtues. Let us no longer invite public acclaim and praise when the next citizen, knowing little of AA, comes up and says to us, "Boy, it's wonderful how you folks have developed your willpower." We should say, "Well, you know what." Then there is this question of money, dough. The drunk has always been a guy or a gal who said that he or she had no trouble that money wouldn't cure, because in the false pursuit of freedom, this meant security, it meant distinction, and to some of us predatory ones like me, it meant power. In that sense, we have abandoned the pursuit. And I think this is very general. As the master himself said, the toughest customer for spiritual insight is he who is rich in the world's good. Now then, by trying to pursue a right freedom under God, and thus having relieved ourselves a good deal of anxiety about our money security, and being possessed, even though we are erratic, of skills and abilities, the total earning power of this society is phenomenal. It is $1 billion a year that we all take in, found money. And indeed, this is a trust. Now, when it comes to money as our society uses it, though collectively we are very rich, as folks go, and well situated for the most part, we have wisely insisted that collectively we can stay poor. We borrowed that idea from Francis of Assisi, and John D. Rockefeller in the early days made sure that it would be that way. Now, here is a great natural advantage. We don't have to have great properties or expensive management. And probably the greatest temptation, should we succumb to it, the greatest calamity that could befall us, next to the abandonment of the principle of anonymity, would be for us to permit this society, in its central agency, our trusteeship, ever to become rich by the donations of well-intended friends. One thing is assuredly so. The wasted years make us naturally want to accumulate a security. The fear of professionalism and a bureaucracy growing up in our midst has turned into a prudent conclusion that we hadn't better do it. And for a combination of reasons, which in some cases means that we're just plain tightwads, it is certain that our services, intergroup and worldwide, will never get rich through our donations. Don't have to worry about it. But let us inform ourselves what these agencies are, and let us never fail to supply their legitimate needs. And let us, particularly in the case of our world services, which operate at a great and remote distance, maintain a reserve which will preserve those services in full strength during a Great Depression or a steep inflation, when our land and indeed the world is going into debt to such an extent that it can never possibly be repaid. Let us, in our central overall effort, pay our bills and save a little dough besides, in the interests of the millions we hope yet to come. These things we can do out of that trifling $1 billion a year we take in. Don't you think so? I do. Now then, we touch for a minute on this subject of public controversy. There has always been a deep instinct upon us from the very beginning that controversy in public with anybody, or a controversy within us of such violence that it would reach the public level and keep people away, would be fatal. And we are a people who have loved controversy. I dote on it myself. But somehow, regardless of all our sniffs and sometimes violence, at this level, we have avoided it. I think only on a couple of occasions has any internal scuffle in our fellowship reached public notice. The smaller ones are healthful, but those are awful unhealthy. I remember a case, for example, where there was a row about who should control the telephone number where you reach AA in the city. And five different crowds got five different telephone numbers, and then some bright guy went down and incorporated a telephone number, and he was it. And I don't know, they got into a lawsuit, and we got a headline because we're snitting over who should have the telephone number. I think the public took this one in good humor, even though we were damn serious about it at the time. But that's a trivial leak, and we know this peril. I think they're having a pretty good one abroad, where, because of lack of translations that we might have supplied, a great deal of people in one country had never heard of the AA tradition. The elders kind of kept it to themselves, them who could read English. And they thought it would be just a swell idea if they got a little government help. After all, this was a Yankee gadget, and they had to shape it to national needs and desires. So if the government paid for the clubhouse, and the government paid for the literature, and the government did this, and the government did that, well, that's what their government did for everybody. Well, there got to be some English-reading guys who did read about the traditions, and a little while ago, a book in their language burst upon them, and all of a sudden we had the tradition group and the non-tradition group. And for several years, they have fought like hell about it. But meanwhile, AA there kept growing and growing. Nobody died off on this account. Excepting, possibly, when this thing hit the newspaper and the boys got really angry and began to use adjectives, which I wouldn't repeat even here. And they were reported in the papers. It could have kept away some customers who might have died. Now then, there is this ever-present problem of communication. Of course, the great communication is in this 12th step. In the early days of AA, there were far more customers than there were sober AAs to do 12-step work. This was especially true in the days of Bob and Sister Ignatia. And we ought to remember them when we think of sponsorship and the 12-step. And in this connection, and as a permanent memorial of what they did, we put a plaque on the wall of St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, which would commemorate and renew in our memory the 12-step job that was done there by that dedicated couple. And I think it worthwhile, when we think of sponsorship, to remember this example of greatness in spirit and action. And I was asked to write these words. The plaque says, in gratitude, the friends of Dr. Bob and Ann S. affectionately dedicate this memorial to the sisters and the staff of St. Thomas Hospital. At Akron, the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous, St. Thomas Hospital became the first religious institution ever to open its door to our society. May the loving devotion of those who labored here in our pioneering time be a bright and wondrous example of God's grace everlastingly set before us all. So when we think of our newcomers, let us not settle for comfort, for complacency, for mediocrity. This too is one of the great perils, because complacency and mediocrity cannot stay still. We must move to greatness in action or in spirit, or we deteriorate. I sometimes hear that people will call AA, and obviously there's a drunk in the household, and the poor wife calls up, and over the phone, somebody crisply says, "Does he want to stop?" Well, I don't know. It's an awful state down here. Bang, down goes the receiver. He got to come and get it. A little abrupt, isn't it? Those of us who go to meetings, and the meetings get large, newcomers come in there. Let us be tender with them. Let us be sure that somebody received them. Let them feel wanted and needed. Let us think of their comfort, their happiness. Our sponsorship can be improved. Then there is this question of opening channels of communication to those who don't know. And how many are there that don't know? since our society came into existence, conservative figures tell us that before us has passed a melancholy procession who have gone over the brink of 25 million men and women. And out of that, we have fished one in a hundred. Shall we not inquire more deeply why this is so? Within the AA tradition, which forbids ballyhoo and aggressive promotion, shall we not better inform our friends in communication? Shall we not set in motion eagerly and inventively new means of reaching this passing stream of misery? Of course, we know that at the start of the procession, they're still young and won't believe they're sick. And we know at the far end, near the precipice, it may be too late. But right out in front of us tonight, worldwide, there are millions who would come in the direction of treatment if they only knew how ill they were, what we could do, and what we could do together in cooperation with other agencies. Greatness in action and spirit always demands that we complacently regard our success. Alcoholics Anonymous has come to the age of responsibility. But clearly, dear friends, its work has only begun. Let us perfect, therefore, our communication. Now we come to a final topic. We all know anonymity is a protective thing, so the skeleton wouldn't walk in the streets, make people willing to approach us. When most of them get in here, they want to be about as anonymous as the New York Yankees. Nobody cares. Stigma's gone. But it still has its attractions for new people and special groups who have their own reasons. This is fine. Here and there, only occasionally when you consider what a bunch of promoters we really are. At the public level, only a few. And then never those with any really evil intent have used the AA name to further other enterprise. And usually that has brought in members, but isn't it better to say that those have been just short-sighted, a little bit blind, a little too ready to seize today's opportunity only to create a huge and immense liability for the future and security of this society. Now there is one final aspect here. What a lucky break, that word anonymity. The deep spiritual bearing of it. And that last tradition. He's most intimately and spiritually related to the first, which entreats us, no matter what our concern and tenderness for the individual may be, that the common welfare is first. And underlying all of these traditions in their several aspects and function is the deep spiritual significance of anonymity. I don't mean technical anonymity, no names and pictures in the newspapers, please. That's just the mechanics of it. What we are talking about here in the protection of us very fallible people is neither shame nor false modesty. It is a recognition that in us the old forces may revive, and that the greatest protection against them is the sacrifice of even legitimate aspirations. After all, God expects us to try to be reasonably secure. He hopes that we shall be somebody in the right way. The leadership of the world is or should be dependent upon people who have had those aspirations and who work publicly for freedom under God, and thereby qualify themselves in leadership of us all. But for us, we know there is a special danger. These are the forces that brought us to the pit. Therefore, our security, our general welfare, indeed our spiritual estate and its ultimate value, is going to depend upon the willingness of each and every one of us to sacrifice at the public level these perfectly legitimate aspirations which other people may have. It is the token of the spirit, not of martyrdom, not of false humility, not of affected nobility. Just let's give up a little something to secure the destiny of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the extent to which we have been able to do this, with scarcely any deviation, under an immense and ever-growing temptation, as the AA name becomes a household word, all for that I am so grateful. Here is our shield. Now then, there is no more subtle form, perhaps no more destructive form of pride than the sort of pride that brags of its humility and its nobility of purpose. So what I'm now about to do is something I have debated a lot about. It has to do with the contribution which Dr. Bob and I, not for any excess of humility or nobility, began to do in the year in which he died. And he, in this all-important spiritual adventure, was the leader and the bright example of greatness in spirit and action. As you know, the old boy had the CA, and after a while his number was certainly up and had gone. So I went often to Akron, and we used the phone a lot. And I hope I said last night that we never had an angry difference of opinion, and we had a division of duties and responsibilities. And there was a kinship there like I shall probably never have with anybody. And Bob was the conservative and the prudent, but never the fearful, I might add. I'm by nature kind of a gambler. Risks are exciting. Bob was a spiritual natural, but the history of my life was an insensate pursuit of approval, prestige, and finally, power. Early in the history of this society, I began to be told what I might not do by the group conscience. I will always remember the day when we, being 34 Clinton Street, some of the other boys getting on their feet and getting good jobs. I was up at Charlestown's hospital. Charlie beckoned me into his office and he showed me the balance sheet in the gold rush days of the 1920s, thousands of dollars a month. Said Charlie, "Look, Bill, your folks are getting on your feet. You and Lois are starving to death. Why don't you move the operation in here? I'll give you a break on the profits. I'll give you a drawing account." Well, from his point of view, from any outside point of view, this was a generous and legitimate proposition. As I went home, I felt kind of good. I could see Lois coming out of that department store. I could see some place to like, some place to go, some security. Lois was cooking when I got home, and the drunks were looking hungrily in the door. None of them paying any board. We were big-hearted with no money. That was one way you could feed the ego in those days, you know. In those days, an AA could go to an AA dentist and say, "I'm an AA, I want my teeth filled." No cost, everything free. Same with the coal bill. Well, anyway, I broke the glad news. Lois wasn't so quick on the uptake, and then the meeting started down the parlor a little later. I told the boys of the glowing opportunity. And as I went on, they got more restless. I could see that they didn't want to say anything. But finally, one of them knew they had to. And they said, "Bill, we know the state you folks are in here. But Bill, this thing rests on its goodwill. No pro could ever do this job of therapy. So you can't do this to us." So spoke the group conscious, and I obeyed for the first time. And as these traditions developed, every one was contrary to my will to power. And I've had to learn obedience. I might right here say, too, before we come to the conclusion, that when these non-alcoholic friends of ours, together with a few of us drunks, formed a trusteeship, which was a recognition that Bob and I couldn't do this job of world service, we at once, of course, began to delegate them everything that AA possessed of a service nature, its service money, its literature, its magazine, all came into their keeping legally. I've frequently been over there with some awful strong arguments, and I have been voted down. I don't even have a vote there. And this has been a hell of a good thing for me. And this makes me interject right here that this, in the administrative sense of our great affair, is the working group conscience of Alcoholics Anonymous, and here they sit. And in them and in their successors, I am sure we can have confidence and we can solve that critical problem of the transfer of the symbol of service leadership from Dr. Bob and me, and in your hands and in theirs. Our destiny can and will be secure. and that long since AA has been safe even from me. But when Dr. Bob was dying, and this trusteeship did not have the stature that it now had, AA wasn't safe from me. And Dr. Bob, one afternoon in his parlor, just after I came in from New York, full of my altercations with the trustees, by the way, just to comfort him in his remaining hours, he kind of brushed that off and he said, "Bill, you know, a very touching thing has happened. An awful affecting thing, and yet it has its comical aspect. Just let me show you this." And he went and got out a long roll of paper and he unrolled it. And it took up a big space on the floor. And in this was the architect's drawing of a dandy mausoleum in which he could be planted along with Annie as became a founder. And Bob looked at it, and his smile was broad. Actually, that guy could be good-humored about even dying. And then he said, "I've been thinking quite a bit about this, Bill. But, Bill, don't you think that would afford a kind of a nice example?" "Well, the Dickens were the example, Bill. Why, for God's sake, don't you and me get buried like other people?" This was not too serious, he said. But the impact, the implications for me immediately became clear. This was the beginning of the enlargement of the tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, not only to abjure from public recognition, but to refrain from public honors for AA work. And soon after Dr. Bob had gone, I got word from my old alma mater, from which I never graduated, and from which I would have been thrown out for poor scholarship had the World War not intervened. All of a sudden, my dear old alma mater thought I should have a degree for being one of the world's leading drunks. Well, it wasn't a very big college, and it wasn't a very big degree, and I thought of Dr. Bob, and, "Oh, well," I said, "I guess not." Well, then along came another one, and this wasn't a very big college either, and that was pretty easy. And then came the great Lasker Award, and gee, every fifth guy that had the Lasker Award got the Nobel Prize. This was the route to Stockholm. Well, it was offered to me. They always give it to individuals. And this time we had a near miss. But again, we remembered Dr. Bob, just getting buried like other people. So we got him to angle it around so that it would be a citation to Alcoholics Anonymous, a recognition of us as a fellowship, and not an honor to an individual. And the San Francisco Opera House was filled to overflowing, and our friends and drunks were standing in the aisles and hanging off the raft. And down came the governor and all these distinguished people. And Bernie Smith, then the non-alcoholic treasurer of the board, received this citation on behalf of AA. And I found myself in the talk of 120 seconds, something unheard of, in which I thanked them also. That was much better, wasn't it? Now then, a couple of years later, a committee of rather distinguished looking gentlemen waited on me in my office and with appropriate emphasis and dignity and enthusiasm, they said that they had come from their university, one of the oldest and greatest in this country, and that on behalf of the corporation, the board of trustees, so to speak, they wished to say to me that the university wished to confer upon me a Doctor of Laws degree, for a stockbroker and a drunk, this seemed like really good going. And when I looked up and found that a Doctor of Laws degree was just about all that a big university could give to anybody, and that the company of people in the world who had held these degrees as laymen was pretty small and, to say the least, distinguished, I felt the old emotions arise. At last, spirituality had really paid off. And then I thought of Dr. Bob. And then I thought, well, if the Alaska Award was the route to Stockholm, what in God's name could we do with this one? And then I thought of Dr. Bob. So I began to ask people. And a lot of people said to me, well, Bill, you deserve this. But that isn't the most important thing. The important thing that this would give a standing to this society. That it would immediately give it a place in the world. Which would bring us support that we don't have. Members perhaps beyond count. It's your duty to do this. Gee, that sounded good. So, we went over to the conscience of the movement in such matters, these fellas here, and we took a canvas of them, and, I guess they'll confess it had them a little rattled, too. And some thought I should, and some thought I shouldn't, and some said, let's think about it. And on this board, we have a very distinguished American citizen. And his name is Archie. And he's over there in the back row, modestly. And I remember on that evening, as we went around the board and we got to Archie, and everybody knows his illustrious father and that great public servant, and he said, Bill, Nobody has a right or a duty or a responsibility to advise you on such a highly personal matter. This is a matter for your conscience. But my dad was a guy who had some ego, and he was sensible of the need for its restraint. So he always made it a rule that never, under any consideration, would he take a public honor for public service. So I just dropped this into the hopper. And the balance was tipped, and the enlargement of our tradition of anonymity, the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, to include public honors was confirmed. So, as best I could, and with some wonder how this great university would receive it when a drunken stockbroker turned them down, I did write this letter. And I'd like to read it to you so as to get it into the record. I thought of leaving it into the files, but maybe this is a good time to share it with you. Dear Mr. Secretary, this is to express my deepest thanks to members of the corporation of your great and respected university for considering me as one suitable for the degree of Doctor of Laws. It is only after a most careful consultation with friends and with my conscience that I now feel obliged to decline such a mark of distinction. Were I to accept the near-term benefit to Alcoholics Anonymous and to those legions who still suffer our malady, would no doubt be worldwide and considerable. I am sure that such a potent endorsement would greatly hasten public approval of AA everywhere. Therefore, none but the most compelling of reasons could prompt my decision to deny Alcoholics Anonymous an opportunity of this dimension. Now, this is the reason. The tradition of Alcoholics Anonymous, our only means of self-government, entreats each member to avoid all of that particular kind of personal publicity or distinction which might link his name with our society in the general public mind. I think that we AAs are fortunate to be acutely aware that such forces must never be ruling among us, lest we perish altogether. The tradition of personal anonymity and no honors at the public level is our protective shield. We dare not meet the power temptation naked. Of course, we quite understand the high value of honors outside of our fellowship. We always find inspiration when these are deservedly bestowed and humbly received as the hallmarks of distinguished attainment or service. We only say that in our special circumstances, it would be imprudent for us to accept them for AA achievement. For example, my own life story gathered for years around an implacable pursuit of money, fame, and power. This anti-climaxed by my near sinking in a sea of alcohol. Though I did survive that grim misadventure, I well understand that the dread neurotic germ of the power contagion has survived in me also. It is only dormant, and it can again multiply and rend me, and Alcoholics Anonymous too. Tens of thousands of my fellow AAs are temperamentally just like me. Fortunately, they know it, and I know it. Hence our tradition of anonymity, and hence my clear obligation to decline this signal honor with all of the immediate satisfaction and benefit that it could have yielded. Gratefully yours, Bill Wilson.